Today on ID the Future, we're happy to bring you another interview with Dr. Tom Woodward, host of the Universe Next Door syndicated radio broadcast. In conjunction with Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture, Dr. Woodward regularly interviews CSC scientists and scholars on various aspects of the debate over Darwinian evolution and intelligent design.
Welcome to the Universe Next Door, where today we're going to move into the area of a very strategic debate that is swirling around an exciting new book that just came out a few months ago, and it's the book that has caused something of a controversy, a discussion, a furor at times, and it is the top book of the last 25 years, in my opinion, that deals with the origin of the animal phyla, the various kinds of bizarre, crazy looking, sometimes fascinating, with all their eyes and their jointed appendages, all the animals that leap into existence in the Cambrian explosion. And the one gentleman who we have with us today by phone from his office in Seattle area is Dr. Steve Meyer. He is the author of Darwin's Doubt, which jumped to the number 7 position in the New York Times bestseller list for nonfiction books and has been garnering an avalanche of reviews, most of them 5-star. Welcome to the Universe Next Door program again, Dr. Steve Meyer.
Great to be with you, Dr. Woodward.
Thank you. I was really thrilled to be able to tune in and at least check out the first part of a debate that took place on the UK's premier radio there with Justin Brierley. I had an opportunity to debate an atheist when I was in London a few years back on that same program. But boy, you just bumped it to a whole new level. And I think that the whole world is listening in a metaphorical sense, at least hundreds of thousands, I think eventually will tune into this incredible radio debate. So if you would just lead us into, before we talk about the debate, explain for those who are new to the program, perhaps, and are tuning in across the United States, what is the basic idea of your book? If you could summarize it in a minute or two, I know that you've probably been asked a million times to do that.
But yeah,
what is Darwin's Doubt all about?
Well, it's about a doubt that Darwin himself had about the adequacy of his own theory. And that doubt concerned an event in the history of a life known as the Cambrian Explosion, in which most of the major animal groups, the phyla, as you correctly called them, first arose. And these new animal forms that arose would exemplify completely different body plans, different ways of organizing tissues and organs and body parts, anatomical structures. So this is a major event in the history of life. The first major groups of animals arise in the Cambrian period. And what puzzled Darwin about the event was that far from these new animal forms arising gradually over a long period of time, as his theory suggested they should, the animals arose very abruptly in the fossil record, and that was something that he acknowledged was, as he put it, a challenge to the views here entertained. And he hoped that future generations of fossil finders would fill in the missing pre-Cambrian ancestors that his theory suggested ought to be there. But in fact, the subsequent discoveries in paleontology have actually revealed that the Cambrian explosion was even more explosive than Darwin realized. It happened in a briefer window of geologic time, and more animals arose during that Cambrian period than even Darwin knew. And so the problem has intensified in paleontology, but what I show in the book is that there's an even deeper mystery associated with a Cambrian explosion than the missing animal forms from the pre-Cambrian, and it's really the mystery of how would the evolutionary process have built all this new complex animal form, especially now given what we know about the importance of genetic information and other forms of information for building animals. If you want to build an animal, in a sense that you could understand this by analogy to our own technology, if you want to give your computer a new function, you have to provide new code, new software. The same thing is true in life. If you want to build a new form of animal life, if the evolutionary process is to be successful in building a new form of animal life, it needs to be able to generate a lot of new information in the form of the genetic information stored in DNA. And now we're finding, as you have written about, other forms of information are necessary as well, which are sometimes called epigenetic forms of information. So I argue in the book that not only is the neo-Darwinian mechanism inadequate to explain the origin of this massive amount of new information that would have been necessary to specify the structures of these Cambrian animals, but also there is a powerful positive reason to conclude that intelligent design, a purposive intelligence played a role in the origin of all this information, because what we know from experience is that information always arises from an intelligent source, whether we're looking at software or hieroglyphic inscriptions or information in a written text. When we trace functional, specified information back to its source, we always come to a mind, not a material process. So the Cambrian explosion, being an explosion of information as well as form and structure, attests powerfully to the role of a designing intelligence.
Today with us is the author of Darwin's Doubt. It is a fantastic, major new player on the field of discussion of the origin of life, in this case, the origin of animal life. And Dr. Steve Meyer with us today on the radio program Universe Next Door is the director of the Center for Science and Culture of the Discovery Institute, which I think, Steve, became somewhat more widely known through the humorous search for your offices by Ben Stein in the movie Expelled.
Exactly.
That was cute.
A lot of the scientists who had been expelled that Ben was investigating were in some way affiliated with Discovery, and we've become the institutional home for many scientists, both here in Seattle but around the world, who are either challenging Darwinian evolution or developing this alternative perspective that we're calling the theory of intelligent design.
Right. And we take our hat off to you all there at the Discovery Institute. Of course, you have a research arm. At least I'm assuming that the Biologic Institute is at least in some sense affiliated with the Discovery Institute.
Well, absolutely. We fund a lot of their research. Mm-hmm. It's headed up by Doug Axe, who's a fantastic scientist.
Right.
Caltech PhD, longtime researcher at Cambridge University, who came to us to start a really first-class research lab that is testing in the laboratory the competing claims of the theory of intelligent design and various evolutionary models.
Well, this is what I find puzzling, as often when I go and speak to groups of evolutionists or just the general public that is interested in evolution. I say, well, what do you think of the new testing that's been done by Doug Axe and the laboratory of results? And there's that kind of look of the deer in the headlamps, didn't know what's going on there? And then it gives me an opportunity to explain how Doug Axe has just brilliantly confirmed the lines of teaching or let's say prediction, in some cases at least, the various ideas of design theory are being confirmed in some ways in a quite spectacular form.
Well, so, Doug and some of our other scientists made writing this new book kind of easy on me, because I had the happy task of synthesizing the results of a lot of scientific research in different subdisciplines of biology and showing that there was really a strong cumulative case from developmental biology, in Doug's case, from protein science and molecular biology, and from other fields, a strong cumulative case against the creative power of the Darwinian mutation selection mechanism. And then conjoined with other evidence, there's a strong positive case for intelligent design as a better explanation.
Very good. And now we are trying to really grasp what's happened just in the last couple of months, as first of all, a very noted expert in the area of the Cambrian evolution has written, first of all, a review of your book, and then engaged in a radio debate. And this gentleman, Charles Marshall, a UC Berkeley paleontologist, and I think he hails from the British Isles.
He's an Australian.
Oh, Australian. Okay.
Also with family roots to New Zealand. And
very good.
Very interesting fellow. Yes.
Very good. Well, I mean, we have about 2 minutes left in this particular segment. We're going to be going on into the interview, the debate that was held on Premier Radio in our next couple of segments. Give us a summary of what he said in the Science magazine review.
Right. That's a really good place to start. Well, I've never been so thrilled at a negative review in my life, because first of all, it was Science, which is the most prominent science publication in America. And secondly, it was written by a very prominent Cambrian expert. And thirdly, the tone of the review was respectful, but most importantly, in critiquing the book, he tried to refute the main argument of the book. And many of my critics to this point have really focused on trivialities that are not central to the argument of the book. There's been a lot of nitpicking around the edges. And what Marshall attempted to do was to argue against my claim that intelligent design represents the best explanation for the origin of the information, the genetic and other forms of information that would be necessary to build these complex animal forms in the Cambrian period. And he, interestingly, did not try to argue his case by saying, well, the neo-Darwinian mechanism could generate all this information. Instead, he took a different tact and said, well, maybe there wouldn't be need for very much new information in the Cambrian period. And what he said was a little bit technical, but he argued that the genetic circuits, the regulatory apparatus, the genes that control other genes, might have been mutated or changed in such a way so that they would affect the expression of the pre-existing genes for building all the parts of the animals differently. So he used the metaphor of rewiring. He said the genetic regulatory circuits might have been rewired in such a way as to eliminate the need for a lot of new genes, and that could have explained the origin of these higher level structures that arose in the Cambrian animals.
Okay, and what we'll do is, since we're just about out of time for this segment, we will go into those rewiring issues here in the next couple of segments and also bring in the very exciting debate that you engaged Charles Marshall in across the pond, as they say, in London. We're today talking with one of the leading and most talked about scientists in the United States today, Dr. Steve Meyer, author of Darwin's Doubt. We'll be right back on The Universe Next Door. Welcome back to The Universe Next Door, where today we're diving into the molecular universe of genes, snippets of DNA wound up around their little histone cores. Dr. Steve Meyer with us today, the author of this exciting, rousing, riveting, like earth-shattering, can I use that word?
There you go.
Darwin's Doubt. It's just a masterpiece. Dr. Steve Meyer, appreciate you referencing your entire scientific team, not only at the Biologic Institute, but across the U.S., across the world. Scientists doing great scholarship have contributed to the sharpness of your book. I think you would acknowledge that.
Oh, absolutely. This was the fun of it. It was putting together. In fact, I had a whole chapter on epigenetic information and the challenge that poses to the neo-Darwinian mechanism, and I drew heavily on the work of Jonathan Wells in that chapter. And of course, you and Dr. Gills have written a really brilliant book about that topic as well. So this is a team effort, and it's an exciting time to do this kind of science because there's so much known in the different fields that really is mutually reinforcing. But a lot of times, the specialists in paleontology aren't talking to the people in molecular biology, and the people in molecular biology don't know what's going on in developmental biology. So as a, I hope, informed generalist and philosopher of science, I was able to synthesize a lot of this information. To quote Darwin and make one long argument for the for intelligent design, Darwin, of course, said that he had made one long argument for descent modification, and his was also very much a synthetic work. So he provided a good model for making a case, and that's what philosophers of science in particular do. We pull together the evidence to make an argument.
To me, the comparison between your book, Darwin's Doubt, and Darwin's own book, The Origin of Species, is a fair and it's a sharp and an adequately, I think, justified comparison. I'm not inflating your ego. You're a very humble gentleman in research, and all your work has been very carefully phrased in a way that is not filled with hyperbole. You're measured in your critiques of Darwin's theory. I just appreciate the respect with which you treat all the branches of Darwinian biological research. And so it's not as anything personal. It's just you're wanting to adequately vet the credibility of the hypothesis that has been presented as virtual fact in the scientific world for many decades. So I applaud you for this effort. Can we talk about Charles Marshall, this gentleman who hails from Australia, but is based UC Berkeley, just south of you guys in the San Francisco Bay Area? What, in the essence, when he's talking about your book, he seems to like part of it. He acknowledges that at least part of your treatment in this book, Darwin's Doubt, is on target. Can you just mention briefly,
is
good scholarship at least?
Yeah, in the debate, he was very gracious and said that the first third of the book, which dealt with paleontology, which is his specialty, was, as he described it, as good scholarship. He said he thought the book was well written. He enjoyed reading it. His critique concerned the second third of the book, in which he claimed that my understanding of molecular biology and this problem that I focused on, which is the problem of the origin of new genetic information, was based on an outdated understanding of molecular biology, in which it was assumed that you would need a lot of new genes and therefore genetic information in order to build new animals. His contention is that you wouldn't need a lot of new genes. At least his contention in the review and when we spoke in the debate was you wouldn't need a lot of new genes. All you would need to do was rewire, all the evolutionary process would need to do would be to rewire the networks of genes, the genetic regulatory networks, to control the expression of other pre-existing genes. And my response to that, first in print, and the article, I wrote a series of responses to his critique in Science, and they're up at our online blog website, Evolution News. Darwinhimself.org, my response to that was to say, look, that's actually a very much question-begging response. He's presupposing, without explaining, several sources of information, of genetic information, the genetic regulatory networks that he thinks could be rewired to produce Cambrian animals without a lot of new genes are themselves made of genes and gene products. And he doesn't give an account of where that genetic information comes from in the first place. Secondly, rewiring genes requires a whole host of coordinated mutations in regions of the genome called cis-regulatory regions, for people who are keeping score at home. But in any case...
Thank you for that reference. I'm doing my cis-regulatory scorecard
right now.
Right.
I didn't mean to get too technical, but it's the point is that coordinated mutations would require an infusion of information. If you had to change a whole bunch of words in a sentence to try to make it into a new sentence, you'd be imparting new information. So there's an information input there. And thirdly, these genetic regulatory networks act on pre-existing genes. And in Marshall's view, these pre-existing genes would have existed in some kind of pre-adapted pre-Cambrian genome. But that's a third source of information that he presupposes and doesn't explain. And in addition, in his own technical writing, he also acknowledges that building Cambrian animals, because they require building, each new Cambrian animal has many specific body parts and anatomical structures that didn't exist in prior pre-Cambrian times, would have required what he calls gene novelties, that is, new genes specific to those individual parts. So that's actually four sources of unexplained but presupposed genetic information. He gives no account of the origin of that information. And I had in the debate already explained that the problem of building even a single gene by the Darwinian mechanism of mutation and selection is actually very severe because of what I describe in the book as the combinatorial problem. It's basically, this is something that's based in part on Doug Axe's work, but also the work of other molecular biologists and protein scientists who have shown that functional genes are incredibly rare within the space of possible arrangements of the parts that make up genes. I use
Steve,
an analogy. Yeah,
can I just jump in here? Because I think this is an important point that when I was reading your book, and by the way, I finished it in literally a little bit under 2 weeks. So, and I was just reading a little bit per day, and I just hardly could put your book down. It is extremely well written. It is exciting. I won't say it's as exciting as a murder mystery, but it ranks number two in just sheer forceful and yet engaging prose. Your work, I think, often would use analogies like a combination lock. Can you just give us that analogy?
Yeah, it's a good way to understand. But the basic problem is that Marshall, in his response to me, is presupposing a lot of sources of pre-existing genetic information. The problem is that neo-Darwinism does not have a mechanism, a credible mechanism, for generating even a single gene or protein, let alone the many sources that Marshall presupposes of genetic information. Here's a good way of understanding why that's the case. Imagine that you are a bike thief, and out on the street you see a very handsome racing bike that you would like to steal. But you go out, and when you get to the curb, you find that, unfortunately, the owner of the bike has taken great precautions against theft, and instead of a normal lock with three dials or four dials, you encounter a bike lock with 10 dials and 10 digits on each dial. Now, assume also that we're dealing with a highly mathematically literate thief who understands that 10 dials with 10 digits computes to 10 billion possible combinations, only one of which is going to open the lock. Now, he also knows that the security guard comes around the corner about every 15 minutes. What's a smart thief to do? Well, I would submit that the smart thief is going to move on because he knows that 15 minutes is not nearly enough time to search all those combinations to have even a remote chance of finding the correct one that will allow him to open the lock. It's far more likely that he will fail than he will succeed. It's overwhelmingly more likely that he will fail than that he will succeed in finding that combination by chance. And by analogy, the same thing is true of the Darwinian mechanism. Even taking into account evolutionary deep time, the 3.8 billion year history of life on Earth is not nearly enough time for the process of random mutation to search the various possible ways of arranging the characters in the genetic code, the A's, C's, G's, and T's, and all the different possible arrangements there are given the length of a genome. The section of a gene on average, maybe about 1,000 base pairs, 1,000 individual right. genetic letters. So it's you're dealing with something that generates vastly more possible combinations than even that 10-dial lock.
And the remoteness of it makes it highly implausible.
Yeah,
we're just about out of time in this segment.
Yeah,
so what I was going to say, let's go ahead and jump right back into the Charles Marshall debate. We're talking today with Dr. Steve Meyer, author of the blockbuster book, Darwin's Doubt. You're listening to The Universe Next Door. I'm Tom Woodward. We'll be right back. Welcome back to The Universe Next Door. You know, Bill, I was thinking last week when I was talking about The Universe Next Door, I can see people's eyes like, what is The Universe Next Door? and you've been a witness to history. We've actually had the author of that book on our program.
Jim Sire
has been with us several times.
That's a great book.
Isn't it a great book, Dr. Steve Meyer? Well, The Universe Next Door, of course, deals with the thought universes, the worldviews, the meta-narratives. That's a hot word that's been used for a couple decades now. And the universe next door of the thought system of naturalism, the assumption, literally the kind of the preferred wanna think this way worldview of many scientists is this thing called naturalism. Sometimes they use the term scientific materialism or even physicalism. And Dr. Steve Meyer, as a graduate, not only with your studies in science in the U.S., but you went to Cambridge University, got your PhD in the philosophy of science, and you're well familiar with naturalism, and that worldview still holds sway for many people today. Would you say that's accurate?
Yeah, I think that is accurate. I think it is the dominant thought form in our elite media culture and certainly in our universities and particularly in the sciences. And it's a helpful thing to define because every worldview has to answer the question, what is the thing or the entity or the process from which everything else comes? Mm. Naturalism answers that question by reference to the matter and energy that make up nature. So the idea is that there are, in the naturalistic worldview, the thing or the entity from which everything else comes is some kind of material or material process. And Darwinism, being the origin story of the naturalistic worldview, is an indispensable supporting plank in that way of thinking because it provides a purely materialistic account of the origin of the complex life we see around us, which is arguably one of the hardest things to explain. And so Darwinism is both a scientific theory, but a theory that also has larger implications that are friendly to that materialistic or naturalistic worldview.
And of course, naturalism is probably, at least from my perspective, playing a role in the evaluation of these Cambrian animals. Can you give us a sense of how that works?
I think that's really true because what happens is when we present the case for intelligent design, the argument is that there are features of living systems that are best explained by reference to a mind rather than a material process. And we make that argument because there are features like digital code or molecular machines that are known from our uniform and repeated experience to arise only from intelligent agents, not from material processes. So we make that kind of argument, and what people will come back and say is, well, but that's not scientific. A scientific explanation has to limit itself to strictly materialistic processes, even if the thing we're trying to explain has never been produced by a materialistic process. Mm-hmm. So there's a kind of limitation on thought that's being imposed on science. It seems like sweet reason to many scientists. They think, we're studying the material world, therefore we should try to explain it by reference to material causes. But the problem is there are many things in the material world. There's some beautiful inscriptions on the buildings outside my office here. I'm in downtown Seattle. The building is a material object, but the inscriptions contain information which is the product of a mind. And so we know from experience that there are certain kinds of things that can't be explained just by matter and motion. And instead, we need intelligence to account for them because we know that intelligence produces those kinds of things. So the argument we're making for intelligent design in biology is that we are actually discovering things inside cells, digital code, integrated complexity in complex molecular machinery, hierarchical information processing systems, and the like, which are known from our experience to arise only from intelligent agency. And therefore, when we encounter them in a natural object, in a living system, as odd or counterintuitive as it may seem, it's actually more logical to infer that an intelligence produced those features of those cells or animals than an undirected material process, because there is no undirected material process that we know of that has the capacity to produce those kinds of things.
Today with us, Dr. Steve Meyer. He's the author of Darwin's Doubt. He's also the author, I should add, of The Signature in the Cell. Signature in the Cell was voted one of the top 100 books of the year 2009 when it came out in the early 2010 publication there in London, the Times Literary Supplement. I bet that was a pleasant shock when you saw that recognition.
Well, it was a complete and total shock, and the Times Literary Supplement would be something in the States like our New York Review of Books. It's a very highbrow,
right,
elite publication, and the reviewer who recommended the book for commendation was Thomas Nagel, who's a well-known atheistic philosopher of science, and that made the recognition doubly surprising. But Nagel, of course, has become a very interesting figure in this debate,
oh, yes,
writing his own book, Mind and Cosmos, which is a brilliant critique, actually, of the materialistic system of thought. The subtitle of his book is Why the Materialistic Neo-Darwinian View of Reality is Almost Certainly False. So,
you know, when Nagel makes comments like that, and now your book is out and the people are almost evacuating, mentally at least, the confidence that they've had prior to this in the origin of life, the first cell being explained in a nice, tidy way. Are you seeing possible the thawing of this vast glacier of unthinking acceptance? Are there cracks in the ice here and there?
I think there definitely are. I think actually quite a number of them, because what we're encountering is a lot of submerged dissent, people who will tell you privately they've been deeply skeptical for a long time. Also, one of the themes of my book was that there's a huge disparity. This is Darwin's Doubt, not Signature in the Cell,
right,
but
right.
There's a huge disparity between the public presentation of mainstream evolutionary theory, the standard textbook version of the theory that we all learn called Neo-Darwinism, and the actual status of the theory when you get into the peer-reviewed literature, not just in biology generally, but within evolutionary biology. You have many evolutionary biologists calling for a new theory of evolution, or they are already busily working on trying to formulate a new theory of evolution because they realize that the mechanism of mutation and natural selection just simply lacks the creative power that's been attributed to it. In particular, it lacks the power to generate the genetic and epigenetic information you need to build new animals. The latter problem, which you and Dr. Gills wrote about, the problem of the origin of epigenetic information, has been widely noted by leading evolutionary biologists. There was a major book published by MIT Press in 2003 by two leading evolutionary theorists in which they talked extensively about the problem that epigenetic information and structure poses to Neo-Darwinism. They said very flatly that Neo-Darwinism lacks a theory of the generative. It explains the little stuff well, but not the big stuff. It doesn't give an account of how you generate new form and structure.
Well, this is at the heart of what we're talking about today, because our special guest with us is Dr. Steve Meyer. He is a graduate of Cambridge University with his PhD focusing on the origins issue there, and he was able to rub shoulders or elbows, whatever the British equivalent of that is, with some of the leading thinkers and even philosophers of science in his day, even Peter Lipton. I think you heard a lecture or two by him before his tragic early death. And then he returned to the States. He was a professor. Dr. Steve Meyer was a professor of philosophy at Whitworth College. I believe that was the name.
That's right,
or university,
right.
Now. And so since you've come to the leadership of the intelligent design movement, I think there's been a lot of fruitful research. And of course, the Darwin's Doubt book is the culmination at this point of all that you've done. The book is available at our website, theapologetics.org website. We're featuring it still as one of our books of the year. It is the book of the decade, if not several decades. I have a friend of mine, Steve Meyer, hope you don't mind me saying this, when he heard someone say, this is the book that will be discussed 200 years from now, he said, well, that's probably because it'll take 200 years to read it.
So I said, no, I hope that's not
no,
true.
No, I couldn't put it down. So it only took me 2 weeks, and that's only part-time, like, you know, half an hour here, an hour there. And it was just spectacular.
Well, I tried to write it as both a scientific argument, but also a mystery story, because there's a profound mystery here.
Yes, it is a mystery story.
And what I tried to do was look at each of the progressive attempts that had been made to solve that mystery and before presenting my own proposed solution to it. So
yes.
There's a little story structure there, which I hope carries the reader.
There is. And of course, we are talking, we're not only discussing the book, but also this exciting debate that was just featured. Let me go ahead and reference the article. And Steve, we're going to be really zeroing in on the details of that debate in our next segment as we get finish up here in just a moment. I'm looking at A Listener's Guide to the Meyer-Marshall Debate, and that's written by Casey Luskin. It's subtitled Focus on the Origin of Information Question, and it's dated. And when you go to evolutionnews.org, you'll just have to scroll down to December 4th. You'll see it right there, a nice picture of the book. And so the Listener's Guide to the Meyer-Marshall Debate, and you can click on a link there. You can just get listening to it. It's highlighted in blue. Of course, that's a hyperlink. Takes you right to the premiere radio station and their podcast. And so we're going to be featuring this discussion that was held just recently between Dr. Steve Meyer and one of the world's leading experts on the Cambrian explosion, the Cambrian animals. And this gentleman, Charles Marshall, teaches at UC Berkeley. And I'm really excited, Dr. Steve Meyer, of the opportunity we'll have here in just a few moments to dive into the heart of that debate and to see the great points that were made by him. And, of course, the response by you as you defended the thesis of this incredible historic book, Darwin's Doubt. We'll be right back with Dr. Steve Meyer, the author, in just a second after a quick break. Welcome back to The Universe Next Door, where today we're speaking with Dr. Steve Meyer. He is the author of a valuable breakthrough book. It is a bombshell, in my personal opinion. It is one of the most exciting science books I have read in my life. I have been raving about it to students, to my friends in the C.S. Lewis Society Network. We've been putting out all kinds of notices and reports as it is now mounted nearly to 400 reviews.
Yeah, we were just talking
on Amazon.com. Isn't that incredible?
That is. We were just talking about it off air a little bit.
With Dr. Meyer.
With Dr. Meyer. And Dr. Meyer, you were talking about at first, there was just some naysayers who just came in to be nasty. But now the weight has shifted on this and a lot more positives than negatives.
Mm-hmm. Well, the first night the book was available for sale by 3 o'clock in the morning, there were already one-star reviews assailing the book's lack of scientific content. One guy said it was mendacious intellectual pornography. Somebody else said it was a steaming pile of pseudoscience, and on it went. And there was a 9,400-word review posted June 19th, the day after the book had been released, written by a grad student out at Berkeley. And it was clearly pre-written. It's a long book. Even a man as bright as Dr. Woodward took 2 weeks to get through it. And this guy had allegedly read it and written an almost 10,000-word review.
Evelyn Wood could have not have gotten through that book that fast.
Call your
speed
office.
Reading. Nor the review.
but so, you know, after a week, it was like 15 one-star reviews, and it was running about 1-to-1, and since then it's been running about 5-to-1. And, you know, it's obviously not a vote as to, it's the reviews that I think, there have been a lot more thoughtful reviews of people who have clearly read the book, and that the book inspires such reflexive vitriol is, to me, an inverted compliment, if you will, because it's showing that the other side is finding what I have to say somewhat threatening, and I'm happy to see their extreme reactions, actually.
And of course, I've been describing it routinely as a tsunami of intellectual enlightenment, of scientific enlightenment.
Well, that's almost as strong on the other side.
Yeah.
Mendacious intellectual pornography.
Well, I'm sorry.
I was going to say, now that's mendacious.
Yeah, I had to look up some of these words.
Yes.
You know?
Well, Dr. Steve Meyer, author of Darwin's Doubt, and of course, before that, just a couple of years, Signature in the Cell, which focused on the origin of the first cell. And you can't invoke natural selection. Of course, some people tried to do that in their critique of that book. And rightly so, I think the referee threw the flag on those particular critiques. And of course, here we have this phenomenon of almost no talk about your book. In the, let's say, high world of Darwinian evolutionary research and theorizing, it's almost like they've discussed quietly, you know, don't comment.
Well, this was really an interesting phenomenon. I think the conspicuous silence in official journals, but we know that the book was duly noted. We had Jerry Coyne, who's perhaps the leading American neo-Darwinist at the University of Chicago, He was writing reviews of the book before it was published. He was writing stuff in May. The book didn't come out till June, and he caricatured my argument as, so what, baby Jesus made the animal phyla? That was his.
And that's absurd.
So we know the book was on their radar and that they were already reacting to it on their blogs and things, but there was this conspicuous silence in official science journals until the good Professor Marshall at Berkeley wrote a very serious and respectful review. It was a negative review, but it was, I think, very positive in the specific sense that A, it was written in Science, but B, he attempted to address the information argument, the central argument of the book, and he took it head on. I think his response is inadequate. I think it begs the question in that it presupposes many sources of pre-existing information without explaining where they come from, but he addressed the main argument. And I would also say that the discussion we had on British radio was very cordial, very civil, very thoughtful. I thought he made a lot of good points and had good insights. He also responded to the arguments that I was making in a constructive way. At one point when I pointed out one of his arguments was that perhaps some of these self-organizational processes could generate the complexity we see in living organisms. I pointed out that all of the self-organizational processes that he had discussed in a prominent lecture that he delivered at Harvard presupposed genetic information. He came back and said, that's a fair point. There was constructive give and take in this. Mm-hmm. And I was impressed with him, even if, of course, he and I still disagree after we had the discussion. But it was the kind of discussion you hope for at a very high level with a serious scientist who clearly shares a passion for the same subject as I do and clearly understands where the really important issues lie in evolutionary biology.
Well, and that's why we're featuring not only your book, but we're featuring this incredibly important Meyer-Marshall debate on the substance of your book. And really, it's the topic of where does this puzzling discovery, which has been growing, I mean, it's the evidence is overwhelming that we do not find linking forms leading from single-celled bacterial or eubacteria, I don't even know what term they might use, up to these very sizable, 2 inches, often up, 3 inches or larger, Cambrian animals with all kinds of complex morphologies, body structure, and you don't find those intermediate forms that are just wonderfully shading or step-by-step gradations as Darwin would predict. And now, in the book, you feature several of the escape routes and you try to show why none of them works effectively in the light of current scholarship. Did any of the escape routes that you outlined in the book and critiqued, did any of them come up in the debate?
No, that was interesting. Not really. One, he did propose, and again, focusing more on the question of the mechanism or cause of the information that would be necessary to build these animals. And that is one of the things that I really appreciated both about his critique and our discussion is that that is the central issue. It's essentially an engineering problem. You've got the gaps in the fossil record are real and they're pronounced and that's a big problem for historical evolutionary biology. But the deeper problem is the problem of mechanism or cause. How would the evolutionary process generate these complex forms of life? The mutation selection mechanism is inadequate. Way back in 1987, Professor Marshall, as a young postdoc, disassociated himself with neo-Darwinism and explained that it was inadequate. So he's been exploring other evolutionary models. The one that I addressed and critiqued extensively in the book that he did raise in the debate was self-organization. But I, as I mentioned a minute ago, pointed out that the self-organizational processes that he discussed and the way in which he discussed them. He talked about how sometimes you can have a few simple rules that are altered in a computer system. And by altering a few simple rules, you can generate new forms of higher complexity, unexpected complexity. But by analogy, those simple rules in biological systems are genes. And he made that clear in his Harvard lecture. And I pointed that out and he agreed that that was a fair comment. And so the self-organizational processes that he alluded to really presuppose, again, pre-existing sources of genetic information. And that's the key question. Where does that come from? No one disputes that if you have genetic information, if you have genetic instructions, that as those instructions are expressed, that organisms will generate phenotypic level, anatomical level complexity. But the really deeper question is, where does the genetic information come from? So that one model did come up in our discussion. But typically, he wasn't disputing my critiques of the models. He had this other idea that he proposed in his critical review that you could alter the genetic regulatory networks, that the evolutionary process could somehow rewire them, and that would account for the origin of new animals without a lot of genetic information. But as we already discussed earlier in the interview, that short description of what might happen actually conceals a whole range of pre-existing sources of genetic information that Professor Marshall was presupposing without explaining.
Well, and again, we have this discussion of Charles Marshall's not only review published in the elite journal Science Magazine. I think it's a breakthrough just to have them take note of it and do a measured, it was not a thumbs up review, but at least it took note of what you wrote. And I think it's really interesting that the name of the, at least given by the editors of Science Magazine, of this review, reference to prior belief trumps scholarship. And I thought that's like a pot calling the kettle black.
Well, that is part of what I argued in my written responses, which we'll also have posted at Evolution News and Views. Mm-hmm. But Marshall's argument was that my prior commitment to theistic belief was leading me to the conclusion of intelligent design rather than the evidence. And in my first response to him, I pointed out that his commitment to evolutionary materialism and the idea that there must have been a transformation of one animal form, one animal phyla to another, or from a simpler animal to the phyla that we see today, was actually governing his view of the evidence. And there's a very specific issue where this becomes apparent. In saying that these regulatory networks could be rewired, Professor Marshall is actually proposing something that we know in real time in biological experiments does not work or does not happen. Whenever developmental biologists have tried to change the central control elements in these genetic regulatory circuits, catastrophic effects ensue. The developing organisms just simply die. And so they're not subject to perturbation, to alteration. That's what we know from experience, from uniform and repeated experience, which is supposed to be the basis of all hypotheses we make about the evolutionary or historical past. This is the rule of reasoning, the very common sense rule. What we know best should govern what we hypothesize about what we can't see in the past. And Darwin used this rule of reasoning. He got it from Charles Lyell, the great pioneer in historical scientific method in geology. And what I argued in my response to Marshall was that he was actually jettisoning this rule, setting it aside, because he has a prior commitment to the transmutation of animal form, or in another way of thinking of that is a materialistic evolutionary account of the origin of animals. So I argued that actually the shoe was on the other foot, and of course that also functioned as a point of spirited contention in our discussion on British radio.
Well, on the bottom line takeaway point, I think we can say that there is good evidence, and even after this debate, Dr. Steve Meyer, your thesis for the explosion not only of animal form, but of information stands on a strong evidential foundation of clear reasoning. Thank you for joining us on The Universe Next Door. If it's okay, we'd love to have you back in a couple months and see how the story is following out at that point.
Sounds great.
Thank
you, Tom, and thanks for having me on.
And thank you. And thank you for listening to The Universe Next Door.
This program was recorded by Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture. ID the Future is copyright Discovery Institute 2014. For more information, visit www.intelligentdesign.org or www.idthefuture.com.